All right, welcome to another WaitingForNextYear.com Johncast. I'm just going to call him Johncast because that's what I call them in my emails and communications on the back channel. And I just like Johncast. Do you like that, John?
Sure, sure. Hi, Craig. Good to be back.
Yeah, we just had to cut off the conversation before I hit the record button because we were wasting all the good conversation. And so let's pick it up midstream. We were talking about just how and I'm sure the rest of you, the audience, the royal you, I don't know. Is that a royal you, John?
Sure. They sound majestic.
Yeah. The you out there in sportsland who would take the effort to listen to this podcast, Johncast, whatever, knows what it's like to feel like a sports freak when you're around casual people at work who really don't know a lot about sports. And John was just recounting some people who just have no concept for any of the things the Indians actually do other than the fact that they're a team from Cleveland.
Yeah, and I wasn't even talking – I don't even know if I was talking particularly about any one person as much as I am just – I'm reminded occasionally that this is kind of a weird thing to spend a lot of time thinking about sports. Like I don't feel like those guys who did Dungeons and Dragons, but sometimes I – kind of get the impression that's how other people feel about me because I care about sports so much. And so every now and then you'll run into somebody who's like, I'll be wearing an Indians t-shirt and you'll feel like in Major League where they ask if you still have a team or something like that. And so, yeah, it's, I think of paying attention to your local sports teams as like just part of being a person. But yeah, it seems weird. Sometimes that's not the way it goes.
Well, there are lots of different hierarchies. I noticed that I was on vacation all last week and down in Orlando, and I happened to be walking through Disney World Magic Kingdom, and I saw a father and his two sons, and the father was wearing a long sleeve t-shirt, Boston Celtics. His older son, I think, was probably around 12. Didn't appear to be a teenager yet, had a Kobe jersey on. And then his youngest son, you know, probably 9, 10 years old, somewhere in that ballpark, had a Kyrie Irving jersey. And so I'm going, all right, if I'm the dad and the Celtics are my team, you be sure that my oldest son is not going to have a Kobe jersey because Lakers Celtics mean something.
So what do you mean that there's a hierarchy? Do you think that the dad, what does that mean?
Well, they're as opposed to your people around the water cooler who know nothing about sports and are like, oh, whatever. These people are presumably sports fans because they've gone to the effort to wear the jerseys, but they're not hardcore enough to realize that a Kobe jersey son does not go with a Celtics fan dad.
See, I like that you're militantly against the notion that someone can be a fan of a sports league. I don't agree with you. But I admire that you have this passion about you.
Well, come on, but Lakers Celtics?
No. I think that the younger a fan of the younger the fan, necessarily the less sort of loyalty he or she might have built up towards a local team. And so I don't think it's weird. Like when I was a kid, I liked to collect baseball hats. And so like I had a fitted Major League, whatever they were back then, not 5950, whatever they were, but I had one for every single team. And I would wear, for like 6 months, I loved the San Francisco Giants. That was just what I think I liked Will Clark or something like that. So I'd wear that hat all the time. But
I don't disagree.
You're allowed to be more polygamous when you're young like that, I think.
I don't disagree. I had a Colorado Rockies hat, and I don't think it was a Colorado Rockies hat. I think it was a minor league equivalent because I went to a Jamestown Expos game in upstate New York one summer. And so then for the rest of the summer, I wore that Rockies hat until I just beat it into a pulp. So I get that.
But even though the Browns and the Broncos have this terrible rivalry, didn't anybody? I'm sure there was some old codger who wanted to beat you up over
this.
Dude, we're talking
jersey of a player. It's kind of an NBA thing where you're latching on to these personalities and family loyalties of the team, be damned. And again, I don't know this family story. I'm just you know, I was just sitting there and they walked by. So
no,
I don't
sound like terrible people.
But it occurs to me that if you're raised a Red Sox fan, that rivalry with the Yankees, that part of the culture is a necessary part of the storyline, and you're not going to find that casual baseball fan wearing the arch rival gear. But in basketball, where it's so personality driven, I think it violates kind of my football rivalry sensibilities.
Well, first of all, I'm really glad that we're talking about basketball again. We always start these things off with you and me talking about basketball, which must mean that it's basketball season, I guess. But basketball is the sport that seems most, like you said, driven by personalities, but also is necessarily the sport that's most, I'm going to invent a word, dominatable by one person. So like the face of basketball can usually be one or two people in a given year.
We know firsthand in Cleveland from
that
LeBron.
That just doesn't happen. Yeah, right, right. And in football, that's not the way that it happens. And so football is more about teams and more about colors. And even as
dominant as like a Peyton Manning is or a Tom Brady is, you saw when Peyton Manning was cut loose by the Colts, he was very deliberate looking team by team. It wasn't like, oh, I'm Peyton Manning, I can go wherever I want and I could just win because I can dominate the sport. It was a very careful analysis of, well, which team is going to give me a chance to go straight to the playoffs.
And that's why, so like Ben wrote I liked his piece that he wrote about LeBron and the summer of 2014 coming up. Not very fast, but like all the, I don't know if you read it on the site today, but it was really nice. And it made me think like everybody's talking about LeBron like he's going to choose the best basketball situation when there's really, I mean, I don't know. Did he choose the best basketball situation this time around? And is there a real reason to think that he's not going to go to the Lakers next time? I don't know. Like I said, I do not know, but like, he's not going to have a real hard time winning at a lot of places, you know, I don't think. But, I basically that's a long way of saying I agree with you. I think that's
certainly an easier time than a dominant player in any other sport.
Yes, that's fair. I think that's fair.
So anyway, that's the quick start to the podcast. We actually had an agenda for tonight because we didn't want to get we didn't want to get too crazy off the beaten path like we did last time.
I was really embarrassed last time. I felt like we were both taking acid and just like spinning off in weird circles. So yeah, I made Craig come up with agenda items.
Well, and you know, we can always find some inroads and offroads there too.
So. Oh yeah, no, I'm still taking acid. I just figured it would be better to do with an agenda.
I never liked synthetic drugs, so
Boston kids.
And with that, Boston people just like they like natural drugs that are laced with synthetic things.
It's but like they're only like finding out about it like a week later. Like, oh man, I didn't know that was laced with PCP. That's awesome.
It's got to be a cool add-on to the story, and then the one-upsmanship and storytelling. I mean, I know it's kind of a cliche. That everybody's got a friend that you tell a story and then, you know, they've got a similar story plus three.
I know a guy just like that. I know a guy who tells better stories than even that.
Exactly. Boston is rife, just full of people with people like that. But anyway, so since we last talked, we kind of wanted to wrap a little bit of a bow around the Art Modell story. He did not get in to the Hall of Fame, as you all know. And I spent a lot of time retweeting. I talked a little bit about it. And I even admitted, I think it was with Andrew, that if he hadn't moved the Browns, that they would have just pushed him right through. Was that with you, John?
No, it was not with me. That was with Andrew.
So anyway, he didn't get in. And, it occurred to me that I just didn't really have much. It wasn't like a celebratory. I didn't have an extra drink that night. I didn't clap my hands. You know, I took some joy in it, I guess, but I took the same kind of joy in that I did when the Mavericks knocked out the Heat the first year LeBron was with Miami. It wasn't like, I didn't feel like I won anything. I guess that's the bottom line.
You know, and I don't like telling people how to feel about certain things that happen.
But you're going to right now.
I'm going to tell kind of a story with the moral, which is here's how you should feel about it. Now, I don't really care about Halls of Fame. And so when people get into these fights, I tend to get drawn into them on an intellectual level because I can, especially in baseball is where I sort of have the chops to actually fight with people about it. But even the Art Modell thing I followed, obviously, and paid attention to. And so, like, I understand all the arguments, and they're fine arguments, and I could totally support smart people who are arguing smart things. But had he gotten it, Halls of Fame don't matter to me. Halls of Fame only matter in so much as people care about them. And I, as much as I try over and over again, I feel like as a baseball writer in particular, I'm supposed to care about the Hall of Fame. Like, it's supposed to matter to me who's in and who's not. And I've even tried, like, I wrote a piece about Omar Vizquel once, arguing that it's okay to argue for him to be in the Hall of Fame. And I was like, but I'm a small Hall of Fame guy, so I don't. And even that's not true. Like, I think I was just trying to be contrarian. I don't care. Like, I've tried to make myself care about Halls of Fame so many different times. And in the end, I guess what I took away from the Modell thing, and this is mostly because I love Cleveland and love Northeastern Ohio, that I didn't want him to get in because I was afraid that something that there would be a scene made of some sort. And now I'm not saying that would have happened, but him not getting in makes that impossible. And I think that would have to me been a much bigger deal than any sort of Hall of Fame thing, that Cleveland could have once again come off looking shabby in the national spotlight, and that wouldn't have been a pleasant thing for me. But for the most part, geez, if he got in, I just it, like you said, it didn't make my day that he didn't, and I don't think it really would have ruined my day had he.
Well, I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I might just be justifying the amount of time I spent talking about it and thinking about it. But the one thing that kind of justified the conversation for me was that it seemed like there were a lot of people rewriting history and basing their opinions and arguments on just out and out falsehoods. And that's the only thing that bothered me. You know, I understand, baseball is a game of stats and comparisons and eras. And I think there's a lot of tangible stuff going on there. But when people were saying, hey, shut up, Browns fans, you were guaranteed to have your team back and you didn't lose and he left you your colors in history. The fact that, you know, that was due to a lawsuit and an appearance before Congress and all these other things, you know, what do you think, you're special, Browns fan? Yeah, kind of. The effort is worthy of the effort. Other fans, not myself, obviously, I wasn't old enough, but the effort that was gone, that the fight was taken in terms of getting those things, I think is noteworthy, and I think it's an important part of the story, rather than giving Art Modell credit as, you know, like it was a good faith gesture. It wasn't.
So because you have feelings about this, and I don't, I will ask you some questions. What do you think owners – I don't know. Ownership in the NFL is such a freaking joke. Like, what should an owner do that merits Hall of Fame induction? Like, there's the argument in baseball that, like you said, there are eras and that this is a museum and we let people in to record the history of the era. And that's how people get around, you know, letting in bad guys or steroid cheats or whatever. What does an owner do to get into the Hall of Fame? I mean, geez,
let's talk about
print money for 20 years and manage a way to lose it.
Let's talk about the Rooney family in Pittsburgh. Cause they're, I don't know if they could be in the Hall of Fame already. The Mr. Rooney, I don't know his first name, but there's an owner who has certainly made tons of money, won lots of championships, run an ideal organization with stability, and on top of it, really pushed the culture of the game forward. I've argued that maybe the Rooney Rule doesn't totally work as well as it's expected and needs to be looked at, but the idea that somebody pushed forward and spearheaded a movement to make sure that minority candidates in a largely minority driven league from a player standpoint, minority candidates were getting interviewed for GM and coaching positions. I mean, that's leaving your mark above and beyond as a contributor to the game, I think. That's the kind of thing.
Okay. No, I like that. That's like one good one. Like I tend to think that Jerry Jones is probably going to be honored in the Hall of Fame. And is Al Davis already in the Hall of Fame? I don't know.
Al Davis is in the Hall of Fame, but he was a CEO of a rival league that ended up making the NFL as big as it was. I mean, everybody likes to remember the doddering old fool at the end of his life, who was running the Raiders into the ground kind of as a joke of the league. But I mean, he was a guy who actually affected change. And I said it before, Art Modell was around when, you know, all these TV deal things were happening. He was involved. He would have gotten swept straight into the Hall of Fame if he didn't have a couple of black marks on his record, you know, going bankrupt twice in a league where you get to print money. It just moving a storied franchise, and then, you know, the bailout not working and having to sell 7 years later to the Biscotti family. Those were the things that kept him out. Otherwise, he would have got swept right in, and it's not important.
So but now that he's been kept out, why do you not feel vindicated? Why don't you feel good about all this?
I feel vindicated just because I think the truth means something, but not because like I won anything. That's what should have happened. It's the truth. It's obvious. You know what I mean?
I guess, but I don't think Halls of Fame are obvious about anything. I think that they're necessarily these fuzzy, like when you said people were, I don't know, you didn't say whitewashing history, but something to that effect. That's what happens all the time. I mean, that's what happens every time a baseball player gets elected. You know, like you forget that they were taking handfuls of greenies in the 1970s or that. I mean, whatever, you know, you whitewash over anything, the steroid era, you whitewash over Bud Selig. History gets rewritten in Halls of Fame. That's the way that it seems to always work. And so I guess this is a small victory that it didn't in this one instance, but gosh, I don't know. They seem like silly institutions to me. Well, and I know I'm supposed to care, but I don't.
Well, now I'm trying to, I don't disagree with you, necessarily. I'm now trying to come up with an incident that would be synonymous with moving a team and going bankrupt twice that would have kept a player out. But it's hard. I mean, I guess the closest thing, is it at all comparable to Pete Rose?
I don't know. People care a lot about Pete Rose, and I don't. Like, Pete Rose strikes me as just an old...
No, but you get it.
Gambling guy who broke the rules and now doesn't get to be like it's like what happens to children in the first grade. Like if you raise your hand and ask to go to the bathroom and then run away from school and play hooky the rest of the day, then the next time you don't get to go to the bathroom anymore. Like that's just the rules. And so many people have spent so many words and hours and gnashing their teeth trying to get Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. It's like, look, it's a stupid honor. He broke the rules and he doesn't get to be in. Like, that's it. And I don't know if maybe Modell didn't break any actual rule.
No.
But everybody decided you weren't good enough. You don't get in. So it's over now. Like, it's not a big deal. It's just you didn't meet whatever threshold, arbitrary or whatever, that we've set, and you're not going to get in. Like,
Well, and I guess if you have to have this level of conversation about a guy, it's probably your first clue that he doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame. It should be easy.
Whenever I've have said in the past that I'm a small hall guy, that's mostly what I was talking about. And again, I don't know for sure that I am a small hall guy, but like I remember I got to see Albert Pujols play most of his career in St. Louis, or at least some of those really amazing seasons. And I remember thinking I'd never seen anybody play baseball like that before, and that that mattered, that I could say that guy was a Hall of Famer.
I saw Pedro Martinez in the heyday in Boston.
Pedro or Randy Johnson or
– It's easy. They go.
That guy's a Hall of Famer. But if that's your level, then really nobody else gets in, right? I mean, you don't put Robbie Alomar in if – you know, if Pujols is the least good player who can get in, you don't get to put guys in like Manny Ramirez or Albert Bell or Omar Vizquel or people like that. You put in guys that you see once in a lifetime, those type of players. And then you end up with a Hall of Fame with 20 guys in it, and the Hall of Fame gets pissed off because there aren't any inductions every year, and they don't get to sell the...
Well, and they should be pissed off because they're in Cooperstown, which nobody ever goes to.
Right. And so, like, my definition of what I think the Hall of Fame should be isn't even what the Hall of Fame wants to be. Like, they want to induct 10 guys every year so that a bunch of fans come out and spend a bunch of money. So, after I gave it all this thought, I was like, God, why would I think about this? Because even my thoughts are at odds with – my goals are at odds with what the Hall of Fame would like to be in baseball. And then I sat there and thought about it, and I was like, God, this is so stupid. Like, it's just a museum, and it's a – and I guess in baseball in particular, the fact that the – I like beat writers in baseball. I think that they are a funny breed, and for the most part, they're nice people. But – it's kind of silly that they're the ones who choose who gets in and who doesn't, like that they've watched every baseball game. Well, no, they watched all of their games, but it's a stupid rule. And like, the more you dig into it, the more inane it becomes. I don't understand the football induction process, but I understand that it's sort of like the stories that I hear remind me of like Congress, where a guy gets up and like shouts a lot and tells one guy the way it's going to be, and then that other guy gets to stand up and shout back. I like that idea much more than these ballots that get submitted in baseball. But
I always love the NCAA coaches poll and the AP poll, and they over the place, NCAA football, and every week the coaches fill out a poll.
Right.
And meanwhile, you know, they've been spending 60, 70, 80 hours planning for their next opponent.
That, and isn't there like self-interest at play in college football?
Of course.
Like, where like for instance, Nick Saban might rank the LSU team like fifth instead of second so that he doesn't have to play them in the championship. I don't know. There seems to be a lot of a confluence of interests, as you might say. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good place to leave it. I guess important or not, it was just there. It was better than him getting in.
I'm mostly glad because anybody I know who did care about it cared about it in the way that you do. And I cared about it in the way that I did, which was that him getting in could have been a black eye for this town that I love. And so I'm glad it wasn't. And I'm glad that didn't come to pass. And now it seems like it probably won't happen. Right. Is that the feeling I get, that this was kind of a resounding defeat?
It's a resounding defeat. I guess there could be some, I just can't imagine a scenario where anybody would ever care more than they cared this year.
Exactly. Right. Right.
So, and let's take that to the next level. I also wanted to talk about so the Ravens ended up winning the Super Bowl. And granted, I did change the channel immediately when there are zeros all over the screen because I didn't want to see Ray Lewis celebrate. But I didn't really take that one on the chin. I mean, the year 2000 when the Ravens beat the Giants, that was brutal because the wound of not having the team was still pretty fresh and the Browns were even worse. Some people like to compare stats of the current Browns to the initial Browns, but it's not even close. It's not the same thing at all. That was just really painful, but this one was kind of, I would have preferred a different outcome, but not the end of the world.
That's probably cause you're growing up a little bit too, is this a little bit analogous to like having an ex, and like if that ex runs off and gets married 3 weeks after you break up, that kind of stings. But if 10 years down the line you hear that she has conjoined twins and kind of a weird thing going on with a guy in a trailer, you feel like, good luck to you sort of thing.
The record, Waiting for Next Year supports people with conjoined twins and also those who live in trailers.
Trying to make me sound like a jerk. I was just making jokes at the expense of conjoined twins. Come on, it's not like I was doing something bad.
Well, I'm just glad you used the politically correct conjoined twins instead of Siamese twins, which has been retired.
Okay, good, good. Well, I was on the style man, the Waiting for Next Year style manual. I was reading that the other day, and they said.
Well,
no,
I just want to know who the Siamese twin lobby was that got that changed. You know, like the
the Siam has a powerful lobby, Craig. A powerful lobby.
The Down syndrome people have the R word now. That's been banned. So was this the S word? We're doing away with Siamese?
That is the S word. That is when I taught high school, I used to tell kids don't use the S word in class. That was what I was referring to. Siam.
Conjoined twins.
That's right. Okay, so what else were we going to talk about? We're trying to get back to our agenda here.
No, so it does. You know, you wish that you didn't have to think about that person anymore. But the Ravens winning
again. Like a lot of times we talk about things, and I feel like I have to remind people that I didn't grow up here, so I don't have the scars that you all have. But I know people and love people with those scars, so I understand it. The feeling I got around town is mostly that, we don't like the Ravens, but we don't like most teams. You know, like now the Ravens have sort of – is this fair that the Ravens are sort of now in Bronco territory, which is that they play an ugly role in our team's past, but we don't – you know, there's no sort of ongoing emotional problem with them. Is that fair?
No, because the Broncos don't even bother me anymore. They changed logos. They don't have any coaches. They seem like a completely different organization.
They don't have any coaches?
Well, from back in the day, of course. Oh. No, but the Ravens are their division rival now. That's it. They're worse than the Bengals, and they're not as bad as the Steelers. That's the way I think about them.
Yeah, and that seems... That seems healthy. That seems about right.
And that was part of my argument with our Modell thing, too.
They're better, right? Like, they're better than the Bengals. And so, the Browns have not beat the Ravens in some considerable length of time, right?
Not
like 5 years or something crazy like that?
I don't remember how long it's been. But, it's not as bad as their rivalry with the Steelers. But, yeah, they don't beat them consistently, that's for sure.
I feel like things are... I have a friend who's a really diehard Browns fan, and every year since I've lived in Cleveland, so a while now, he tells me, like, right around summertime, like when baseball's going strong and I'm, you know, the Indians are cratering, he goes, you know, this year I really think the Browns, they've sort of put something together here this year. And so I'm really looking forward to that conversation this year because he's sucked me in. So every year I feel that way too. Every single year I'm like, wow, they, you know, like their wide receivers may not be fast, but they really run some good routes. And I don't even know what that means or what that would look like were I to see it. But I get sucked in every year. So I'm pulling for all you guys.
Well, I wasn't totally crazy this year. I said – I think I had the Browns at 6 wins. They ended up with 5.
With any number of wins in this upcoming year, are you willing to even bother?
I'm on it because I'm writing it. I wrote it already. And it's not so much a prediction as where, you know, I'm benchmarking them, where they should be.
It's a projection, right? Yeah.
No, but it's not like – It's also placing an expectation on their off-season activity. It'd be like looking at the Indians who are in a developing cycle and they won 70 games or 75 games and knowing what their holes are and telling Mark Shapiro before he has a chance to acquire talent or Chris Antonetti that you expect this team to get better and win 85 games next year.
Okay. And so what do you what is your expectation? 7?
No, I'm straight to 8 this year.
Straight to 8. Okay.
This team was built on the idea that they were going to build through the draft, and I know that Tom Heckard's now gone, but he had 3 drafts. I think they were 3 good drafts. They're a young team that should have gotten better year over year over year. I think they've improved the coaching staff. And so it's on them. They should be looking for a minimum of 8 wins this year. And whether that means they need to go get 2 more corners and a safety or what, I'm not here to pick the shopping list. I'm just saying based on the baseline of the roster and how it grew, if 8 wins is not their minimum goal, they're doing it wrong.
I think, you know, it's really – that makes so much sense, especially in football, the way that football works. Like it should be impossible to be as mediocre as the Browns have been for as long as they've been in football. It really should be difficult to pull that off. And it probably is difficult to pull it off. They have exceeded all mediocrity.
But I've grown as a critic. Instead of me taking it on the chin when they don't get there, instead of me being stupid for saying 8 wins, it's not my fault. That's where the development of the roster is. It's up to them to take it from that 5-win plateau, 3 more wins.
We need to have a good Will Hunting moment. It's not your fault, Craig. It's okay. No, it's hard to feel that same way. So you said that the Browns are built through the draft and that they're sort of ready to take this next step and that there is a methodology or a mix of ingredients or a process through which you have to pass. And that seems to be true in football. And one of the reasons that things get frustrating, I would imagine, for Browns fans is that if you recognize that there is a necessary process through which you must pass, then the fact that that process keeps being aborted every 2 to 3 years is frustrating because everybody pretty much knows that it's a 5 or so year process to turn a bad team into a good team. And that process is longer the worse your team was. So if your team was, you know this better than anybody as the partner of a Colts fan, but the Colts didn't get really, really bad, so they didn't have to take a really long time to get good again. The Browns were really, really bad. It was sort of a roster-wide infection. And so you had to sort of – the process that they had to go through to get better is much longer. I wish that it worked that way in baseball, and it doesn't. And so like the Indians made all these weird signings this weekend, and they aren't really building through the draft. It's just sort of like rolling the dice with a little bit of leftover money.
I get it, rolling the dice.
Yeah, it was an unintentional. I mean, that was a pun that I made.
When before we got on, you said that you were freaking out about Dice K. So go ahead.
I wasn't. I was paying attention, and it seemed like there were lots of. I was paying attention on Twitter, is what that means. That's what I tell my wife. When I say I'm paying attention, it means I'm watching Twitter.
Well, let me ask you a question to lead into the Dice K conversation.
Okay.
What could possibly be wrong with signing Dice K?
Absolutely nothing. Unless you're a racist, I guess. No, it's fine. Absolutely nothing is wrong with it. It seems like there's a lot of money. Like when I saw his base is over $1 million, if he makes the team out of spring training, that seems like a good deal of money to me. But you know what? I have decided that I'm not going to write about it anymore. It's not my money. I'm really tired of talking about, you know, and it struck me this year with the Hafner thing. Like everybody's like, oh, Hafner's washed up. There's no point in bringing him back. And I kept saying, look, you either bring him back or you don't. Like, it's not like that's going to go somewhere else. So it's not your money. So I don't understand why it would be bad to bring him. Like, it's either having an extra guy or not having an extra guy. And this whole argument about, but it's too expensive. I've made that argument probably more often than most people have, but it's a stupid argument because it really is not my money. And so I do think that they maybe overpaid a little bit on the base for Dice K. I think if I read it right, it was like 1.5, I think, on his base if he makes the team out of spring training. And then he has incentives up to $4 million, which, again, seems high. But it could be a high reward, I guess. Our pitching staff's funny. So last year, the starting five, let me see if I can get this right, were Masterson and Ubaldo and Derek Lowe, and then Josh Tomlin, and I'm pretty sure it was Genmar Gomez. I looked this up, and he was the one out of spring training, at least, who made the team. And then obviously there were a lot of moves in and out of the rotation throughout the year. But this year, only two of those guys will still be in the starting five. And other than, who's the guy that they signed to be their number three, the wife beater guy.
Brett Myers.
Yeah. Other than him, we don't really know who's going to fill out the back end of the rotation. So,
by the way, was he convicted of beating his wife?
No, just by me, I think. I don't know. That's just how I refer to him.
Okay.
So I think I told you this before. I used to write for a humor site. And one of the first posts I ever wrote was, am I allowed to say bad words on these podcasts or not?
Yeah, I don't care.
Okay. Brett Myers, : still a prick. And the story of the post was that Brett Myers had told one of his teammates on the Phillies at that time that he had been traded to a Japanese team, and then he had videotaped it. I don't know if you remember this story. It was actually, I think it was Kyle Kendrick. It was somebody who turned into like a reasonable player who wasn't bad. But so there were at least two terrifying parts of the story. One, that Brett Myers is like is like that type of guy who like
Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah, who then like goes extreme and screams really loud. But then the other part was that Kyle Kendrick, who is a Major League Baseball player under a contract, thought that he could be traded to a Japanese team and took it seriously and was freaked out and was like calling his family. So anyway, I wrote that post and apparently Phillies fans really didn't like it. So I got a lot of hate mail for that post. So I sort of still blame Brett Myers for some of that. So I'm not real happy about him. But anyway, so we've got those three guys and then the back end. Of
well,
the-
and I got another wife beater story too, because Will Cordero was
glad we have an agenda tonight, Craig.
Will Cordero was beloved in Boston. And then, of course, I went to school there. They signed Will Cordero because they needed a good buddy for Manny Ramirez before he was – while he was still a part of the Indians.
A drug mule, if you will.
What's that?
A drug mule?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. I'm sure he was, actually. Not because I'm trying to think if Manny was convicted, and he was. So we can say drug mule. Anyway, so – but the Indians go to Boston. I'm sitting in Fenway, and – they loved Will Cordero when he was in Boston. And now the thing that he was convicted of while he was a member of the Red Sox that they glossed over while he was a member of the Red Sox, they're screaming from the stands, the wife beater! You're a wife beater, Will! And just screaming at him. And I'm like, man, to be a Boston Red Sox fan, it's the greatest thing in the world. They just gloss over history. The minute somebody leaves, your public enemy, they don't care what you did for them. Mo Vaughn, forget him. He's an angel. You know? Nomar, who needs him? They turn on everybody, and I think it's a healthier way to live as a sports fan.
I don't know. I have issues with Boston fans. I just don't like it. Like, I don't want to talk about it because
you know who doesn't feel like they have issues? Boston sports fans.
Well, I sound really – like, most of the time I think that I'm not an evil person, but when I talk about them, I don't sound nice, and so I don't want to talk about them. I don't like them.
All right, well, let's get back on track then. So Dice K is back in the rotation.
So this was a really long way of saying this. They turned over 3/5 of their rotation, and that's a good thing because their starting rotation last year had an ERA well above 5. I think it was like 5.3 or something. It was the second worst in baseball or something like that. So is it like you said, I do not see anything bad about signing Dice K. And by the way, they didn't sign him. He still has to make the team. It's a minor league invite, a minor league contract with a spring training invite. And the same thing with Giambi. I almost I almost mentioned today on Twitter that like I would have probably preferred Travis Hafner over Giambi. I probably would have. And I probably would have leaned towards giving Hafner a major league deal over giving Giambi a minor league deal with a chance to make the club. But it wasn't a big enough deal. And I knew somebody was going to freak out on me. And I was like, oh, I'm glad that they signed Jason Giambi, I guess. Like, it's fine.
All right. So tell me something. I look at the Jason Giambi thing and I look at Dice K and I point both those straight back to Terry Francona and some people he wanted. Either for clubhouse reasons or XYZ. Am I putting too much emphasis on Terry Francona at this point, or is he really a major force in building this team right now?
I totally get that feeling, but I don't know why I have that feeling. But I get the feeling that Terry Francona did not want Hafner on this team, for instance, that he was like they made kind of this big stink about how like, well, we don't want to have a designated hitter. And that was. From what I understand, that was Francona sort of saying that he wanted roster flexibility and didn't want a designated hitter. And I don't think anybody was saying that Travis Hafner would be a designated hitter. They were saying he could play 3, maybe 4 times a week, which if Giambi makes the team is exactly how often he's going to play. I do think Francona's sort of driving this ship a little bit, and that's fine. I think he probably should. He's earned the right to do that, and I was an advocate for re-signing Hafner, and when they didn't, it was pretty clear that Francona was a part of the decision not to. And you just say, okay, that guy deserves the right to make his team the way he wants to make his team. If he didn't want that guy here, I always operate with the assumption that I know way less than the team does. So they probably knew something that I don't know, and that was probably the way they wanted to go for reasons that they don't have to share with me.
If you had to guess who was a better clubhouse guy, would you guess Travis Hafner or Jason Giambi?
I don't know.
I would guess Giambi.
Really bad water. But the one thing that I always liked about Travis Hafner is that he did seem that he wanted to be here. And that even when his contract was up, I think he wanted to come back. I don't think the Indians were willing to match the Yankees offer there. And I think that's why he went to New York. I think the Indians said, we'll see you later. So I think that he liked being here. Now, whether that made him a good clubhouse guy or not, I don't really know.
Well, just so you know, the story on Hafner was always that he married a local girl
Right.
and she and he liked it here.
Well, so did Tommy, right?
Yes.
To open an old wound. Yeah, I thought it was funny that I almost tweeted this today
An
too.
old wound that I've been told I must heal.
So there were two 42-year-old left-handed DH-only options on the market, and the Indians signed the guy that they did not build a statue for. I thought that was kind of interesting.
A guy that they haven't we learned something about building statues for living people?
I don't know. Did somebody build me a statue? Oh, you mean, okay. No. No, I don't know. That seemed silly when they did it. Like, not only is he still alive, but he was still playing, and like he was still going to play on other teams. That seemed weird. But like the front offices really came out looking funny on that because they sort of fetishized him while they picked him up for the second half of that season. And then they're like, yeah, no, we're going to let you go. And we don't really want to sign you for the next year because we have Travis Hafner sitting. It was weird. That whole situation is weird. I don't know.
As I asked Scott on Twitter if we could have Joe Banner come in and nix it like he did the white flag thing.
Just get rid. Have they put the statue up yet even? They haven't, right?
I have no idea. I don't think so.
I think it's like coming this year, which is could be weird because he might still be playing for another team this year.
It's
Like
just a
that.
really bad idea. I wouldn't even feel like it was a bad idea if it was Omar, to be honest with you. Something about Tomy bugs me.
Yeah, no, it's not Tommy in particular. He seems like a nice guy, and maybe he's worthy of statues. But I remember when they that night that they announced it, and it was weird because Tommy was back on the team, but the Indians. It was one of those like August times with the Indians where like if they won 5 games in a row, they would have been kind of in it, but they didn't, and they lost 5 games in a row, and all of a sudden they were way out of it, and it was raining really, really hard, and they were unveiling the statue, and Carlos Baerga was there in like snakeskin pants. It was just this weird, surreal moment, and you're like, what is this last place team doing? Unveiling a statue for a current player who's likely going to play on another. It was weird. It was just really weird. I don't know who came up with that idea.
Yeah. Well, I want to put another, old thing to rest. The Cleveland Indians have signed a Scott Boras client.
Who is that?
Daisuke.
Is he? Okay.
I was looking up his numbers and I saw that was his agent. So it's time to put that to rest. The Indians can now deal with Scott Boras clients.
We had Chinsu Chu for years, and we had dealt with Scott Boras. I think Scott Boras is really overblown. I think he's become sort of is it a synecdoche? Is that the right word for like being an agent? He's like the one that everybody points to as like the standard bearer for agents. But what agent doesn't want to get his player the most money, and what agent doesn't want to take his player to free agency? I don't think he's a bad guy at all, really. I think he's fine.
In baseball, you couldn't be dumber if you don't take your player to free agency.
Well, and he doesn't seem sort of crass. I don't know if that's the right word, but the way that Drew Rosenhaus is in football, like Boras seems like he's good at his job, and like he's not just like style and fancy cars and hair gel. Like he seems like he has a track record of doing good by his players. The one thing I would be worried about when
His
I
prospectus, his prospectus's leak, where he says, this guy is worth X, Y, and Z because of X, Y, and Z. Those things are always a little bit outlandish.
Of course they are. Of course, I mean, and that, but they, but if I were paying him to do that, then I would want him to be arguing that for me. Like I remember the binder. He had binders full of statistics for Alex Rodriguez when he signed that $250 million deal with Texas. And like he had it was it had indices and appendices, and like it was filled with charts and all this interesting. And it's like, yeah, it was probably mostly crap, but or at least it was the truth shown in a very particular way.
Well, let's look at this. Hang on a second.
It's a job.
All right. $80 million over 7 years for Carlos Gonzalez with the Colorado Rockies. 2 days later, he got $96 million for Adrian Beltre with the Texas Rangers. I'm just – this is in 1 year.
His he did down in South Florida. Now, okay, so you, I assume you've heard all about the sort of steroid probe that's been linked to the University of Miami. And
sure.
Okay, so Boris is now he is making his clients go to a particular sports training. He's going to start a sports training center down there, and it's basically to combat that guy. Like and it's not altruistic. He's not saying like, oh, drugs are bad for baseball. He doesn't want his players to get caught. He doesn't want them to forfeit that money because he doesn't want to forfeit that money himself. It's fine, but I'm not saying he's noble, but he does a good job at what he's supposed to be doing. Like he's, I don't know. He
no, it's fine.
Eye to me. He just, that's his job.
And no. And people don't hate the player, hate the game.
Yeah. Hate the players. That's how I feel about it. If you are disgusted by this, do not be disgusted with the owners because they'd love a salary cap, and do not be disgusted with Scott Boras because that's his job. Tell the players, Tell the players that what is most important to you is parity, and that what is least important to you is them being able to make their market value. Because that's the trade-off. Either you get a salary cap and players will not be paid what they're worth, or you players get paid what they're worth and you have the league that we're left with. You don't get to have both. I mean, football players don't get paid what they're worth. Basketball players don't get paid what they're worth.
But unanimously, baseball fans don't think players are making what they're worth. They think they're making way more.
That's because fans are stupid, though. They don't understand market economics. If somebody is paying you this, and if people are competing with one another to pay you that, then that's what you're worth. I mean, if a bunch of people want to pay you something, that's what you're worth. And that's kind of the way it works in baseball.
I know what you're saying, but you know what I'm saying.
I don't know. Yeah, does it look bad that these guys make this much money? Of course it does. But appearances have nothing to do with it. I mean, people pay for MLB TV subscriptions, and they pay for tickets, and they pay for beers, and
But we've been down this road before. We're all paying for it, whether we like baseball or not, and that it will end someday. People don't think it's worth that. Just because the system has graduated to this level doesn't mean it'll always be this way.
Look, I actually hope you're right, but I don't think money's – I don't think there's going to be some plug pulled. I don't think the money's going to fly out the bottom of the bathtub here.
It will stop growing.
Maybe it will. Maybe it will. I don't know. I do wonder right now. It's interesting that all three teams have a comparable number of franchises. And is that sort of the saturation point of the American sports mind that, you know, about 30 teams is what we can handle from producing revenue standpoint? I don't know if baseball has more places to go unless they start going to Japan, really, you know, and that's been talked about. And football, it's been talked about going to Europe, I understand. So that's the way they're going to continue to grow revenue, I think. You can't pack those stadiums. People aren't packing the stadiums as it is. That's not where the revenue streams are. But you make more teams. And I don't know. I don't know if you can make – I bet you could spread some baseball teams in the Pacific Rim, and I bet you could spread basketball teams almost anywhere.
Mexico.
For baseball or for
– Baseball.
Baseball, okay. Yeah. Yeah. There are places to grow.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Once we start getting down the roads of economics, that's one of the places where the podcast is not quite as good as all our tables and charts.
Oh, because we can just talk out of our butts.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's hard to kind of create that visual of, you know,
of me actually talking right directly out of my butt cheeks.
The pool itself is not going to shrink, but the growth rate, you know, as you know, the inflationary model of the nation, it gets a little bit crazy.
The Laffer curve. Isn't it Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
I don't remember. I think that's a wildly overrated movie.
I think it's rated perfectly.
I guess it depends on who your friends are and how much they want to pretend like they love to watch it constantly.
Oh, no, it's not. I don't know. How many movies can you really watch constantly, though? There are only a few. Do you know what I watched yesterday?
Groundhog's Day with Bill Murray.
I like that movie, actually. I used to teach that movie in conjunction with the Shakespeare play Othello, believe it or not. They're very good together. But the other movie that I watched just yesterday that's an amazing movie that I should watch more often than once every 5 years is Raising Arizona.
I like it. I wouldn't want to watch it that often.
The Coen brothers have this weird thing that makes me want to watch their movies a lot, you know, like to find little things about them. And
one, I was watching Kill Bill Volume 2 on cable this afternoon. I felt the same way.
Oh, really? About Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah.
Okay. I still haven't seen his new one, which I feel like I have to.
Django Unchained.
That's right.
It was good. I would say it's not as quality of film as Inglourious Basterds was, but as I've said multiple times, it's a lot more fun. It was more fun on the first watch than Inglourious Basterds was. It just won't be as much fun repeatedly.
Okay. I liked Inglourious Basterds sort of in spite of myself. I didn't want to like it very much, but I ended up liking it and liked watching it, you know, liked it more the third time I watched it, more than the first time. I think I couldn't get over how uncomfortable I was the first time I was watching it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. The scene where Christoph Waltz is drinking milk, and then also the scene where in the basement bar.
Yeah.
The tension in that movie was really uncomfortable on the first watch. You couldn't really enjoy it until the second or third watch. I think Django, in contrast, you'll enjoy it most the first time you see it and less in subsequent viewings. But I might be wrong on that too. I don't know. That's just my perception now.
I think Tarantino makes me uncomfortable partially because if I think too hard about it, I feel like what he's saying is something that I don't agree with about revenge and about violence and about the way that the world works. And maybe that's that I don't want the world to work the way that he has it work in his movies, or that I really fundamentally disagree with one or the other. But when I think too hard about Quentin Tarantino, he makes me really uncomfortable with being a human. And so then I feel like I'm just watching these movies for gore, and then I feel bad about myself.
But I love revenge movies. I love them, love them, love them. But you know me, just from, you know, my personality online on Twitter, I just want everybody to get along. I'm the furthest thing from a revenge movie, but I love them. So I think it kind of plays to my darker angels that, you know, I only let out in fanciful ways, you know, in Tarantino movies, not in reality in my real life.
Well, and that's what, like, I don't know. Do you want to talk about Tarantino for a little while, or should we stop for a couple minutes?
That's
okay.
Fine.
So. One of the things that made me uncomfortable, particularly about Inglourious Basterds, is that it's a revenge fantasy, and that's fine. You know, like the way that Kill Bill is a revenge fantasy about this fictional bad guy who does these bad things, and then this fictional character goes and has a bunch of revenge, and it's great fun. Inglourious Basterds is obviously different. You know, there's a historicity to what's happening there, and there's. So it is an uncomfortable analogy to say that because the Nazis killed Jews like cattle, that a good revenge fantasy would be for Jews to kill Nazis like cattle. And that isn't comfortable. You know, that's not the lesson that anybody should be taking from any of these things, but that's sort of the uncomfortable spoon he ends up putting in your mouth when you watch that movie. And while I haven't seen Django, I feel like it might be a similar, like he's playing with history there, and that makes it more, I think from his perspective, which is why he did it, it makes it edgier, which is great. And that's what sells movie tickets and all these things. But for you, there is a sense of, there's a sense of trauma associated with those types of historically founded problems.
Well, but
aren't in Kill Bill, which are just sort of fun.
I would disagree with your Inglourious Basterds characterization just a little bit. And you know, once you get too technical into how these things, I mean, you're really doing low-level psychology on the director or the writer. And sometimes that could be dangerous because
wasn't that low-level, was it?
No, well, I just don't want, I, no, it's not low-level, but
I was just laughing.
Okay. But I think, you know, it's not that they wanted the Jews to kill Nazis like cattle. It was more like, if you remember, there was a small band of really terrifying Jews who were putting the fear of God into the Nazis. So it was almost like setting an example to spread terror across those people, to let them know that there was a resistance out there, not really to take 5 million of them out.
No, yeah, no, and that's not what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah. That's enough Tarantino talk.
Well, I mean, that's really the coolest.
If Denny were here, he'd be shouting in the corner, "Godwin, Godwin, Godwin."
Yeah, well, it's hard to avoid Godwin's Law when talking about Tarantino's career, because he made Inglourious Basterds. I didn't do it.
Did you realize we just got through talking about Tarantino for like 5 minutes and we didn't even run into the thing that gets Tarantino in trouble more than anything? So I feel like we've pretty much succeeded.
Right. Well, naturally.
Yeah.
Well, that's not my fight.
Make jokes about conjoined twins. So
I'll leave this podcast
is not without controversy.
You know, everybody's got to fight the battle that they were born to fight. And there are certain ones that people fight against Tarantino that just aren't my fight.
That's fine. I like him. I think he's funny. He's sort of self-obsessed.
Whether you like him or not, I think we're a better world for having him doing his art.
I don't know if we're better, but we're more interesting.
We're better.
Okay.
The last thing about the one thing that I was concerned about with Tarantino is that, you know, his longtime editor passed away a couple of years ago. She was like hiking in the mountains of California and she passed away, and she worked hand in hand with him on all his films editing. So I was a little bit concerned about how Django would turn out, you know, without her on board for the first time. And so at least he said it was very painful to work without her, and that there wasn't a moment where he was editing the film that he wasn't thinking about what she would do. So I guess her memory lives on, but I was concerned about what it would do to Tarantino's work, not having her a part of it.
Interesting. No, I didn't know anything about that.
So anyway, with that, we had one other pop culture topic that was on the agenda, unlike Tarantino, which was not. You and I both happened to be watching House of Cards, the
yep.
Netflix produced TV show, starring Kevin Spacey. And I think I'm 8 or 9 episodes in.
I watched the whole thing. I finished it this weekend.
Oh, goodness.
This is what having a newborn will do. We sit around and watch TV a lot.
Well, and this is on vacation in Orlando. After 8 p.m., there's nothing to do but what you would normally do at home anyway. So we scoured Netflix. We were rocking Netflix. So I'm going to try and stay as spoiler-free as possible, but what are your thoughts?
I like it. So I'm sort of an addict of whatever you would call that kind of television. I don't know if you call it serial TV, but the sort of thing where
– I call them hour-long dramas.
Yeah, but where they have narrative arcs that stretch over entire seasons as opposed to sort of self-contained little episodes of things that happen. So I don't know, like the difference between Law and Order and The Sopranos or something like that, if that makes sense. So I'm talking about the second thing where stories take several episodes. I love these types of shows. And so I was really curious to see what is it called? House of Cards? Is that right?
Yes.
And I kept reading all these reviews of it, and which sort of whets your appetite for these types of shows. I end up reading about them before they ever come out. And what everybody kept writing about was how groundbreaking it was, not because the show is particularly good or bad, but because of the Netflix sort of distribution model that everybody was so interested in. And I guess, I mean, I get it. I get that that's neat and that that's a new thing. That they released all 13 episodes at one time, and that's really exciting. But that's how I watch a lot of TV. Like I don't have a DVR, which I know I'm like the last person on the face of the earth that doesn't. So I don't have a DVR and I don't have premium cable. So I end up watching things in like massive quantities when I can get them on DVD or when I can get them through Netflix or whatever. And it's not uncommon for me to watch like, I don't know, 6 hours of TV on a Saturday through DVD. And so this is how I always watch things. Anyway, I thought House of Cards was good. I didn't think it was great, but I did like it. I enjoyed it. And I don't think the distribution model is life-altering, but that's probably because I'm not a visionary.
No, but it's really important for Netflix because they're the ones who can give you that. They're not bound by a weekly schedule and they are bound by subscriptions, of course, but they don't have to program your time for you. You do that for you. So by buying the show and releasing it all at once, they're creating demand for something that HBO doesn't want to deliver. They're creating demand for a style of delivery that Showtime doesn't want to deliver. And the show itself, I think the show itself is great because it has Kevin Spacey and it has Robin Wright, who are both pretty, although Kevin Spacey had some pretty smarmy moments after American Beauty. And sometimes it takes me a little bit to get over the fact that I'm not so sure that he's actually interested in women in real life.
Wait, I didn't think he's not, right?
No.
Or did, okay.
No. And sometimes it takes me a minute to, spoiler alert, he has a fling with the hot young reporter. But that happens in like episode one. So it's not really a, it's not really a,
Spoiler.
no, it's not really a spoiler. The whole show is kind of based on that. Now, if you were to tell me that they kill off the reporter at the end of the season, I'm gonna, I don't know that to happen. So
My lips are sealed. I won't tell you anything.
But, no, so I think the show is great because the performances are great. Robin Wright is very, very good. She's probably the strongest performer on the show. Kate Mara is just unbelievably cute and gorgeous.
Oh
And
yeah, I didn't like her at all. That's the young reporter, right?
yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't like her. I don't know why not, but I had problems. And I think so. The reason that I thought the show was good but not great is probably the reason that you think it's great. I didn't think that the characters were really one of the things that these dramas I was talking about that I like that they tend to do so well is that they make bad characters good or good characters bad, or maybe it's even just bad characters be interesting or vulnerable. They don't even have to be good, but they have these streaks that make you like them in spite of knowing how bad they are.
Right, they make you
This
root
doesn't
for
do
the
that.
brutal killer Tony Soprano.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. That's the archetype of the whole thing, I guess. And I didn't find myself ever feeling for Kevin Spacey's character in this show. So I mean, he's kind of, I was reading something, they unearthed Richard III recently, and so somebody was writing a review. This only the New Yorker would do this, God. They were writing a review of the Kevin Spacey show, and they were talking about how he's very Shakespearean because he does all these asides to the camera, sort of like soliloquies. And as I was watching, I was thinking, oh, he's just like Iago, the guy. Now I've talked about Othello twice in this podcast, but he's like the bad guy from the Othello play who's just always scheming and always setting one character against another. And he's always smarter than everybody else, and he always has more information than everybody else. And he almost always wins because of that. And that's sort of how I th that was m Kevin Spacey didn't strike me as vulnerable in this role. And that, I think, it was hard to follow him for 13 episodes and never feel anything for him. That was how I ended up leaving the first season.
Well, and I would argue that, have you ever seen The Wire?
Yeah.
The Wire had no heroes.
No, but I felt for every last one of those people. I mean, yeah, every single, like even Stringer, who was probably one of the darker, badder guys on the show. I think you end up.
Well, yeah, I thought
I don't really
Marlowe.
feel for him, I guess.
I
Yeah,
thought Marlowe was the darkest.
yeah, and you don't feel much for him, but you feel for almost everybody that he comes in contact with. But yeah, I think, and maybe that's about House of Cards. It's not just that Kevin Spacey's
But
characters.
tell me though, you didn't feel bad for you weren't feeling. First of all, it's easy to find the reasons not to like Kevin Spacey's character. His character is Frank Underwood, Francis Underwood, and he's a congressman, and he's a little bit on the he's certainly a manipulator, and he's trying to get things done, and he's lying, cheating, stealing, looking to do everything else. So it's easy to find reasons not to like him. And by the way, this show did a masterful job, even though I or at least so far. Of taking political characters and not making issues of politics.
Yeah, you need to watch the rest of the season.
Okay. So maybe it got a little bit preachy.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't really get preachy, but the political issues end up playing a much bigger part in a few of the later episodes. And then you also see more of Frank. I think there are clearly some parts of his character that you don't yet know. And there are big things that he does that you haven't yet seen. So I feel like you should see the whole show and see what you think. I mean, it's necessarily dark. And I think that's part of the ingredient list, right? Like when you're making these hit shows, it has to be dark, like Dexter or The Sopranos or.
But I was going to finish the point and just say that Spacey's character was vulnerable at points between, you know, his interactions with his wife, who they have a very complicated relationship, and then also his interactions with young reporter Zoe Barnes, played by Kate Mara, where she was. You know, she was clearly the one without any of the bargaining power at the beginning. And that fluctuated at points where she really kind of tortured the old man a little bit.
For sure. And it's totally interesting about power dynamics. I think that's what the first season is mostly about. And he says that in all of his asides, power is more important than wealth. And how do you get power and how do you use power and things like that? And that's what the first season is about. And it tells some really interesting stories about power. I just left it thinking, I didn't like any of those people. That's how I left the first season.
That's the way I left Breaking Bad.
Oh, wow. I like a lot of people in Breaking Bad. In fact, maybe the only guy I don't like is the main character, but I like a lot of people in Breaking Bad.
The only one I ever liked was Jesse.
Yeah, I still like him. Them all.
But that's it. That's it.
I don't know.
Who else?
Okay. Hank? You don't like
no.
his non-conjoined son?
Can't stand his son.
No, I think that those are good people. I like those people.
They're so irritating.
Wow, you're real hateful. The piece of work there, Craig.
The sister-in-law is detestable.
Yeah, no, I guess I don't care for her all that much. But I like most people on that show.
Do you remember when the son got all whiny about one in the car?
Yeah, I remember when he got whiny about the car he actually got, which was a PT Cruiser.
There you go.
But I thought that was funny. I thought that was a funny thing. Like, I used to teach 16-year-old kids. That is totally how 16-year-old kids act. I thought it was endearing in its own way.
Made me hate that kid.
I liked it.
Well, anyway, I guess that's our break on House of Cards. You should watch it and check it for yourself. I'm not ready to put it up with The Wire and Breaking Bad.
I don't want to make it sound bad. I would highly recommend watching it. I liked it. I watched the entire second half of the first season this weekend. So I definitely liked it enough to do that. And I get nitpicky with shows. The other one that I just started that I liked, and we don't want to need to talk about it, but the new show that I watched was The Americans that I did like. I liked quite a bit. So I'm curious to see if they follow that one up well.
Well, and I'll leave you with this last point. This is the way I think people do want to watch TV. This is the way they want to watch programs. And it's not TV when you're watching it like this, by the way. It may be on your TV and whatever else, but it's not being programmed for you. You're going to program it for yourself. It's why rock radio has disappeared. But there's an interesting guy in technology. I can never explain what he does, but he's been a technology writer, podcaster, written books, written for PBS. His name is Robert Cringely. And he wrote one of the most brilliant kind of forward looking articles about how somebody, maybe it's Apple who has $140 billion in the bank, takes over the entertainment industry. These production companies don't have cash on hand. Hardly. They produce something, they sell it, they broadcast it, they take in the money and they go straight out, they pocket it and they go out and they buy new shows. So it really wouldn't cost that much for somebody with a lot of money in the bank to go out and just when like this show came up, House of Cards came up available, they would present it to an HBO, a Showtime, a Netflix, and somebody would buy it. In this case, Netflix bought it. They finished filming the show. They put it, quote unquote, in the can, and Netflix now has it to sell on their service.
So let me say two things, and then I think we're done. So what about this? One thing is that my wife was reading this article, and she said that Do you know how much Netflix pays to stream every episode of Mad Men?
No.
It's $1 million an episode that they paid for the rights to be able to stream it. So I don't know how many episodes Mad Men has, but would you say 40 to 50, right? Somewhere in that range. So they've paid $50 million, let's say, for the rights to Mad Men. It's got to be cheaper than that to make your own content, to make your own good content.
Absolutely.
That's insanely expensive. And HBO won't sell to Netflix anymore. I mean, that's got to be what started this whole thing. HBO will not sell to Netflix. No HBO shows will go on Netflix.
Well, no. And in this case, for Mad Men and Netflix, AMC is a middleman.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the first thing. That, of course, it's got to be cheaper because Netflix is getting raked over the coals for content right now. The other thing that I thought was really interesting about it, and the only thing that made me think twice about this distribution model being disruptive in any way, is that...
Can I interrupt for 1 second?
Yeah.
So the production houses in Hollywood and the TV networks like AMC are the record companies in the music model.
Yeah.
These independent producers will find ways.
Right. They'll sell to whoever will pay them for their stuff.
Right.
So anyway, the second thing was that I don't know if you read Alan Sepinwall at all, but he writes about TV. And he got ticked because somebody spoiled something that happened on House of Cards for him. And I thought that's really funny. And that never would have happened in any other scenario because he's a television critic. So he always had the pre-release copies of the shows and could write up his review and then submit it the minute that the episode ended. He always had that ability. This is the one chance that it was sort of like a democratization of media distribution. And that just him saying that he got pissed off at that somebody tweeted something that spoiled House of Cards for him was really interesting to me. Like that is the thing that was new about this to me, that because I'm used to seeing everything years after it happened. You know, like I was years behind on every show I wanted to watch because I had to wait for it to come out on DVD because I wouldn't pay for premium cable. So this is the one time I've probably watched an entire show before anybody else did. And that was kind of neat. Even before the critics.
And so all you had to be was like that. All you had to do was be a crazy obsessive who streams things fast and won't leave his house.
And this was a show, let me remind you, that I didn't love. God knows what I would do if I came across a show that I really loved that did this.
So Netflix reportedly paid like $100 million for this.
Did they really? I don't understand this. Maybe we'll talk about this another time. I don't understand. I was talking to my wife about this. How do they measure their gains, you know, from this? Because is every new subscription attributed to people who are subscribing to watch this or what? I don't know how they count how successful this little project was, but between development, it's going to be Netflix is trying to survive.
If you could go back into Netflix's database and to run stats, I can only imagine how much fun you'd have.
Do you know? So like I was in between jobs a few years ago and I was talking with this ad agency and they wanted to hire me as like a numbers guy. And I said, okay, like what kind of numbers do you want to work with? And they were like, well, we keep telling all of our clients that we'll get them this many Facebook likes. And they don't really know what that does for them. And they want to quantify the Facebook likes. And I was like, all right, like what kind of data do you have? And they're like, well, we have how many times people have liked us. And I was like, that's all you have? Like, I don't think I can do anything with that. Like, I could just attribute quarters to that or something stupid. But like, if all you have is that, I don't really know what the hell I can give you. And they're like, I don't know if you had like a model that we could plug numbers. And I was like, that's not how models work. You don't just plug in one number and get out.
All you have to do is create something and then say industry experts estimate.
I guess that's why I didn't take a job there. I did not want to be an industry expert. It was like, yeah, we have 12,000 Facebook likes, which roughly equals $50 million if I've done the math right. So, yeah, I passed.
I would have loved it, that would have been a fun job because you could have written the anonymous blog on the side,
like lying all the time, lying for a living.
So a client thinks they're getting $1.2 million in value every year from the Facebook presence that they're paying $30,000 to my company for. They're not.
There should be anti-kickback statutes for that sort of thing.
All right, now that we've taken down another industry.
We did not, you know what? I don't think we've stayed close to our agenda, but I feel like we did better today.
No, we did. We talked about Art Modell.
Yeah.
We talked about the show we wanted to talk about. We just mixed in a little bit of Tarantino.
And conjoined twins.
And Netflix.
Okay, yeah. Then that was really everything I had.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, and you and check out. Do you have anything this week? You said the Indians topic were exhausted for Monday.
I'm gonna write if I have a chance tomorrow night. I know I started writing something not long before we got on, so it won't be finished for tomorrow. But I will try to write it tomorrow night. But I have a rough outline. What about you?
I have a Browns post which I'm not overly excited about, but. I quoted something from it, so I'll have to clean it up, finish it, and pump it on out.
Right. So. I'll try to get something up Tuesday.
All right. Well, this has been an hour and 15-minute long Waiting for Next Year.com John Cast. Waiting for Next Year.